Project Optimism Vaccine. I'm Steve, and joining me today, Jack Eason's here.
Hey, Steve. What's up?
Well, I'm actually not even going to bother introducing Adam Myros, and I'm just going to get right into knifing him. He told us he was going to be a little bit late today for the recording because he said, and I quote, "I'm returning from the grocer. He didn't, I'm coming back from the grocery store. No, he's returning from the grocer.
I would say a grocer. Is this a regional thing? What's happening here?
I think either one's correct. Yeah, it's regional.
Yeah. The main issue here is like, what is the year 1923? Some guy in a fucking little white cap and a black tie is scooping beans into Myros's burlap sack.
Absolutely. You have to ask, I mean, from Adam returning from the grocer, if perhaps he couldn't have had a young lad in a cap bring the groceries to him, maybe on some kind of a bicycle, and drop them off and throw him a tuppence for his trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's called a DoorDash. it's all come full circle. I don't understand your issue here. Like, what is the utility in saying grocery store instead of grocer? This especially when texting, like, you know, one is much more utilitarian.
Okay, so you're going with brevity as your excuse for using a goofball.
It also sounds better.
It just sounds better.
It sounds better. Grocery store.
I think a lot of people just say the store.
Well, that's like just Kroger. That lacks specificity.
Yeah. Because you'd be like, you'd say, "Oh, I'm coming home from Target," not like, "Oh, I went to the textile emporium." Like, what the fuck?
I mean, this is true. I mean, we don't even know what store you're coming back from.
Yeah,
Adam,
what store
honestly,
are you coming
in
back
ways
from?
I texted that in a future text. I went to Meijer, which was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, always a mistake. It's too large.
I will give you a pat on the back though for saying the proper name, because a big problem with Michigan folk, I mean, there's quite a few problems, but one of the major ones is they make everything plural, even though it shouldn't be.
Oh yeah.
So,
well, is it plural or possessive?
Yeah. See, I don't know, but it's never just Meijer. It's always Myers, and it's never just Kroger. Nah. It's Kroger's. It's very,
I can see this. Between that and the militia they have trying to kidnap politicians, I could see problems within the state.
There are merits to that pursuit, right?
I don't know. I'm not saying we should kidnap the politicians. I don't think we need to hold on to them for that long.
Well, my dad told me that it was good that they were trying to kidnap her, because I guess during COVID she was like on a boat or something during the lockdown period. So.
Get
her ass.
Seems like a major problem.
Yeah.
She's on a boat.
Gee. The famously indoor activity with others, being on a boat.
Well, it's kind of solitary. You're limiting your exposure.
Yeah. I don't know. We're actually not here to talk about the Michigan militia and their plot to overthrow the state government, or Myros's use of antiquated terminology when going to the store. No. We are talking about a man that he wouldn't fit in 2024. He is a purely masculine figure from another era. And I'm so glad we get to talk about Mr. Steve Barquette today. And, you know, I think we've covered both our fondness of certain figures like Mr. Steve Barquette and our fascination with them. And these are the ego auteurs, essentially, where you have someone who decides that they need to make a movie so badly that they're going to write it, they're going to direct it, they're going to produce it, and they're going to star in it. Okay. And where this gets really interesting is not when you have, you know, Ben Affleck made Argo and I don't give a fuck, or Orson Welles made whatever and it's brilliant. That's fine. It gets really interesting when you have someone who is a complete Hollywood outsider and they just persevere and they make this stuff anyway. And I think we've seen kind of an influx of these folks in the last, say, 20 years or so, just because with digital filmmaking, it's become maybe a little bit easier and more accessible.
Too easy.
Some would say too easy.
You got to weed out these fucking pretenders. This should be a craft for a total goddamn lunatic.
Yeah. So Yeah, I mean, you get this stuff all the time. And if you don't believe me, it's not just the Neil Breens and the Tommy Wiseaus. You can go on to, you know, Amazon Prime or Tubi, and you will find these folks who are doing it all. And maybe they shouldn't be, but it can produce some interesting art. Now, if you go back a couple decades, it gets a little bit more interesting because, you know, you're paying for physical film stock and there's a little bit more to it. It's not just grabbing your buds and, you know, filming something in your backyard with an iPhone. It doesn't work that way. So then you have people like John DeHart, lawyer turned one-time filmmaker who made the incredible Get Even, a.k.a. Champagne and Bullets, which is a brilliant piece of work. And part of the reason why these movies are so interesting or compelling is because when you have outsiders who have a dream, they, I don't know, it's definitely the ego, but they rarely compromise their vision in order to make something more comprehensible. And they have supreme confidence in their ability to create something, even though they don't have the vision or the skills to execute whatever it is they think they want to do. Now, there's another category, and it is probably a category that has the fewest amount of people in it. In fact, I can't think of anyone else who fits into this category other than the man we're talking about today. Steve Barquette, Hollywood outsider. And yet, when he decides he's going to write and produce and star in a film, it is shockingly fine. It's okay. And if you were to say, hey, this is, this was produced by Dino De Laurentiis and it's some random director that you've never heard of, or this is a Jim Wynorski joint or something like, well, there's no boobs, so it wouldn't be a Jim Wynorski joint. But,
There's a little boob.
But like not like, you know, the Wynorski.
No, there's not Wynorski boobs. No, yeah, we're not in that territory. But
the point is Barquette, he comes off like he's playing like he could be anyone. He could be any of these other like late 70s, early 80s B movie auteurs that sort of sprouted up, your David Decatos and whatnot. And yet he's not. He's just this guy. He's just a fucking guy. And he did it not once, but twice. And then after he made his own movies, and this is my favorite thing, he did continue to make B movies, but not as a director, producer, or writer. He did it as an actor, which I think is probably his weakest suit, which is great. He ended up starring in a bunch of Fred Olen Ray and Wynorski joints. So you can find him there. But,
well, yeah, I think he fits in as a bit player. I feel like you're maybe overstating how fine these movies are, but we'll get into this.
I think you guys are underselling the power of Steve Barquette.
You see, I think your problem here, Steve, is that you're saying this might be a category of one, but it's probably not. It's a category of probably quite a few people. It's just that the end result isn't remarkable enough to draw interest. You know, when someone is like the wrong level of competent, then the movies just become, you know, a beige paint on the wall. You know, there's probably a lot of this sort of thing. It's just, who would know? Because you would never seek these movies out because they're just kind of present. They exist.
No, I don't know. I disagree. I don't think Steve Barquette has got the juice necessarily. He's not popping off the screen, but there's something here in his ambition and his execution and his refusal to compromise. Because if you look at his first movie, 1982, The Aftermath, if someone came to you and as a first time filmmaker, let's say you're a producer, and they were like, you know, hey, I've got this great idea for a movie that I'm going to direct and star in that I wrote, and it's about, you know, a post-apocalyptic Los Angeles wasteland that an astronaut returns home to, I'd probably be like, well, maybe dial that back a little bit or rethink what you're doing or consider that, you know, maybe you won't be able to pull off all this stuff. And Barquette pulls it off. Who invented the ghouls from Fallout? Steve Barquette did. Okay.
I mean, there's no question the aftermath has shockingly solid production values. I genuinely do not know where this film came from. The problem is that it's once you have really shockingly solid production values, like Adam says, then you start assessing other things in the movie. This is the problem. It's a very easy movie to watch, so you start looking elsewhere, and that's where it kind of falls apart, because it's also a very slow, meandering film that's not quite about anything particular and has no characters.
Yeah. And the other problem, I think, that kind of gives The Aftermath in particular a bit of a sleepy vibe to it is something that we have not been able to avoid during Hunk Month at all. And that's...
don't call this part of Hunk
Month. Are you saying Steve Marquette's not a hunk? Come on.
Steve's been trying
this
to...
This is May. We're now in May, yeah. Steve. And this man has never met Arnold Schwarzenegger.
He's a hunk. And the problem is it's this voiceover, this like sleepy voiceover that we've been plagued with for like poster. 4 straight weeks.
It's a poster for The Aftermath where someone drew the hunky Steve Marquette. And then you watch the movie and you realize Steve Marquette is basically a dad and not even a particularly like dad bod.
No,
dad.
Just a dad,
like literally, you absolutely would not look at him twice if you saw him, you know, sitting down at the fucking whatever Texas steakhouse or whatever. He's just some guy.
No, he looks like he doesn't quite have the 16 beer Jeff Foxworthy. That's
right. Yeah, he definitely doesn't have the delts that are on the cover here, where he looks like he's got a fucking turtle shell.
Yeah, not traditional. But yeah, he's definitely like, this guy can crush a case of Miller Lite in an afternoon. Like, no doubt about it.
You look at this dude and you're like, this is a man who has opinions on domestic draft. Like, no question.
Yeah, and he fucking loves a good garage beer.
I mean, he is, this movie is the product of exactly a certain type of boomer dad, you know? Like, they're hyper-competent individuals a lot of times, or you could say even pre-boomer. This is what's fallen away in American society.
The ability is what we lost.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there was this ability. You know, if you asked my dad or his dad to build a house, they would, and it would not be a shack. You know, it would function perfectly fine because they would do the work. They would figure out how this is supposed to be done, and it would function. And yeah, that's not something like if you ask anyone from our generation, if you ask me to build a house, Jesus Christ, it would be impossible. Like that seems like the farthest thing from a reality that I can imagine.
It's true.
Like,
I'd end up writing a thought piece redefining what house means to a generation. that would be our solution.
Yeah, I think that is
he really like this film, both of these films to an extent, but especially I think The Aftermath is really like the perfect example of that. Like this guy who probably doesn't know jack shit about making a movie is tasked with doing so. He wants to make something. So he sits down and he figures out how it's fucking done. And he pumps out something that is, for all intents and purposes, it looks like a movie. It sounds like a movie. Is it a movie? I'm not entirely sure. I think that where this really goes astray for me is in the edit, because both of these movies are paced abominably. like I've never seen, like, both of them have these... You can see what he's going for. Both of them have these huge action climaxes where he's storming some sort of base to really cut out evil from the world here. And somehow these half-hour-long action-packed sequences are impossibly goddamn boring. Like, it's almost like you can't physically pay attention to what the fuck's happening. All sense of space just completely deteriorates. And it just becomes this like endless thing where it's cutting back to him firing a gun and you're just like, fucking get on with it. And that's the last thing that action movie should have you say.
No, I actually think that because most of The Aftermath in particular, it's workmanlike in its execution, and it's slowly paced enough that Barquette doesn't have to flex at all. But as soon as he gets to the big action scenes and he has to do all this quick cutting, that's where I really like perked up, because there's some real dizzying shit. Talk about like no sense of space or place or like understanding where anyone is in the grand scheme of this big shootout. There's this one part where he's like behind this blue car and he's like shooting at people. And then they're cutting to people shooting at him. But the way that they're cutting, it looks like the bullets are coming from a completely other, like different angle. And this happens yes, another yeah. time earlier in the movie when he meets the babe that he beds later that night. But she's shooting at him outside of this like red Jeep. And it's the same. It's the exact same thing. But you're willing to forgive it just because it's just this one instance. But when it happens like 20 times in a row during an action scene, you're like, why does it look like he's running towards the bullets? I don't understand.
Well, that's part yeah. of the problem with the construction is that, I mean, I think it becomes most evident in action sequences because these action sequences have a kind of a required structure to them. Like an action sequence is generally, you know, you have two sides facing off against each other, which requires some kind of a geography. But ultimately, all of the scenes are like this. There's two modes of scenes in the aftermath, and there is either incredible, like there's plot slash incredibly on the nose messaging stuff, which there's one point where they take solace in a museum and they're just staring at statues of ancient civilizations as if to ponder, what is civilization? Will we too come to pass? And it's just like, you know that sequence came about because Barquette probably was like watching other movies to learn how to make a movie, and is like, usually they think about some things, so here's that sequence. But it's like every, like Adam says, every sequence is this kind of sludge. Like there's no forward momentum in either of these films at yeah. all, and the action sequences are really where it comes to form. You're like, yeah, these are literally, this is just shots. This is just shots stuck together in a row, but really the dramatic sequences are the same. It's just dialogue strung together. It doesn't forward anything. It doesn't tell me anything about these people. And then there's the voiceover stuck in on top, which I do in the aftermath particularly, I do very much get the sense. And he reshot a huge chunk of the aftermath. He apparently finished it in the late 70s, and he's like, in classic hubris cinema, decided he didn't like it, so he just got a bunch of different actors and reshot a huge chunks of the movie, apparently, you know, as you do when you're already working completely outside of the studio system. And it really feels like the voiceover in the aftermath is absolutely stitching together something. Yeah. What that is, we'll never know. We're just left with what is now.
It's hard to say.
That adds to the strangeness too, is the release dates on these, because you're talking about, oh, this was finished in the late 70s. Boy, if you told me it was finished in the late 60s, that would make a lot more sense to me, because these movies just, they are out of time. Like, they yeah. don't look correct for the era at goddamn all. They look so at least 10 years older than they are, mm-hmm. both of them. Yeah,
yeah, that's that. Yeah. That threw me for a loop, too. And I will say, too, in the aftermath, again, I don't know if this is to Steve Barquette's credit or with whatever crew he surrounded himself with was like, hey, let's do this. But I love the lack of natural lighting whenever he does an interior shot. Like, there's so much where it's just like, here's Steve Barquette bathed in red light. Here's Steve Barquette with some cool blues. Or when they're in the museum and it's just like, no, it's pitch black, but we just light up these dinosaur skeletons for dramatic effect. So I don't know, man. Shout out to Steve and his artistry. But
no, I mean,
it does feel like something from the 70s more than something from the 80s.
It's like, and I really cannot overemphasize how the first 10 minutes of the aftermath, how good it is compared what, like, what wading into, like, okay, this is some guy who decided to make a movie. There's fucking space shuttles. There's composite shots of like a shuttle flying through space. There's a crash. There's roving, marauding gangs of, like, you know, guys in with machine guns and pickup trucks chasing people, lining them up. They shoot a dude and his head explodes, and there's a full like head explosion sequence. It's all this stuff, and you're like, who is this man and how did he get all this together? Like, and really that first 10 minutes is like, it's, and like there's there's like matte paintings of like the destroyed LA skyline, and it looks great. Now they use it a lot, but it's
what's so
great.
Weird is like that that sort of stuff, the miniature work, the stop motion, the puppetry, the matte paintings, especially, like, these are not stuff you would see in a Fred Olin Ray movie.
Right, yeah. Or Wynorski would never. He would he'd be like, that stupid painting took longer than it takes for me to make the damn movie. We're not using it.
Yeah, which is why it's so bizarre, because you'll see things like that where you're like, okay, this is like a step above that. But then you'll see, like, an obvious jump cut because he doesn't know how to splice film correctly.
Right, and
you're like, what the fuck is happening?
But it's like he has all that down in the start, at least. Like, there's so much. And I think this is part of what maybe soured me on the movie overall, the experience. And maybe in time I'll grow to love it because it's so goddamn weird, is that there's so much promised in that opening 10 minutes. Like, you really get this sense of, like, this is a genuinely outsider, like, making good. And then it just, the movie just grinds to a halt. It just stops. Yes, it does. You're just sitting there going, like, oh my fucking god, will this ever end? Yeah. And yeah, like, his attention to detail stuff, I feel like, and some of the people involved, I'm trying to remember the exact things, but, like, it felt like there was maybe an overlap. Like, does this man know Roger Corman? Was he, like, friends with him or something, and was, like, kind of angling in? Like, it has that feel of a Corman joint of around that era, as of maybe a very broad range of eras as we're discussing, because it does feel like it gone anywhere from, like, 63 to 79. But it has all those elements to it that you could see this completely being a Corman joint, except that Roger Corman would never let a film pace like this go out. Like, he'd never.
Oh, no.
He would cut, like, honestly, give this movie to Roger Corman. Give it to Joe Dante in 1980, and you probably have a pretty fucking sweet movie at the end of it, honestly. You know, give it to one of his guys. But it's just such a strange mix, and it really is just that it just grinds to a halt, and you're just kind of, like, left sitting there going, it's not so incompetent that I'm, you know, like, marveling at its construction. I'm marveling at how good it was, and now I'm kind of treading, like, treading water with it. And it's he defeats himself with his competence, effectively.
Yes, he's competent at virtually everything except for editing. Like, he just seems to have no understanding of, like, forget about the goddamn 180 degree rule. Like, this thing is just zipping all over the place, where it's just like, it's like something you could show in film school to be like, this is why these rules exist, because as a viewer, you watch this and all of a sudden you're like, your brain just shuts the fuck down and you're like, I don't know what's happening here, but I hate it.
No, I don't gotta follow the rules.
I mean, he makes Sid Haig boring. Also, Sid Haig is in this movie, just as another insane thing. How do you make Sid Haig as the chief villain kind of dull?
And that's an weird to me. And I thought at first, like, my initial thought was like, okay, Barquette doesn't have the juice. It's got this, like, sleepy voiceover. Maybe during the editing process, he kind of realized, I am not a compelling on-screen presence. And so he just used, like, every dull cut of Sid Haig that he had, because it's just like any other filmmaker would have been like, yeah, give me a little bit more, maybe this next one. But Sid Haig is just totally, totally just, like, fucking anemic in this movie. Yeah. And so I thought it was all ego. But then the ending of The Aftermath, Steve Barquette allows his character to get shot and killed, which is, like, not a very, I don't know, it doesn't align with the typical ego auteur
move. It's a super dad maneuver. Like, it's like at the fucking Road, basically. I mean, it's Cormac McCarthy's The Road, except I'm just going to say even worse than the existing movie adaptation of that movie. this is even more boring than that, which is, frankly, an achievement.
I don't know. But I think the post-apocalyptic, like, sets are better on The Aftermath. So it's
visually it's a little bit more interesting. That's because The Road was adapted more like 2005 or whatever. It's part of that just gray cinema era.
This is brown sludge.
Yeah, but that this early 2000s Hollywood is like the, I think, the low point for cinema generally, except for like cheesy CG horror, and even some of that was terrible. But yeah, yeah. I think the conclusion is absolutely his handing the torch to the boy. The boy, by the way, is his real life son, which fits fully with the family affair aesthetic of the whole thing. And his son gets a kick, and then to me, the final like just punch in the gut from sitting through this whole movie, the kid wanders off to the sunset and he gets his own fucking voiceover too. They just swap voiceover, but of course it is the kid, his voiceover is still as a child, which I think is actually maybe inadvertently accurate, because this kid is going to be dead within a week. I don't care what Burkett is suggesting. This kid's going to die almost instantly, so that voiceover is at him, best him looking back like a day ago.
He's doomed to die, and Burkett again. Space, obviously, we understand that he does not grasp filmic space, but he also doesn't grasp like how to convey the passage of time. Like, I have zero idea how much time is supposed to have passed in this, and thereby, like, it's impossible to invest in the relationships that he's supposedly forged. Like, has he taught this kid anything? Has he known him for more than 2 days? I can't fucking tell. Like, I have no idea. That's what it feels like. It feels like he went to the museum where the old man conveniently died, and then he and the kid went on, like, a day trip to meet this sexy lady, and then here comes Sid Haig, and I don't know. It's hard to put any weight into this sort of like father-son relationship, because they feel like the movie has not committed to it. They feel like they've known each other for 10 fucking minutes.
There's a whole section where they were with him and sexy lady, who apparently was Andy Kaufman's longtime girlfriend, or longtime for as long as Andy Kaufman was around, which is not long enough. And the boy, and they all gather together and like form this kind of family functioning. And it doesn't really work for several reasons. First being that once you move away from the like miniature work of desolate cars and the matte painting of a torn down LA, when they're just in the house, it's just a house, and they just walk around, and it just looks very domestic and normal. And then, the film doesn't commit to kind of teasing out. Like, I don't think he can. Like, Burkett is not a good screenwriter. He doesn't know how to convey character. And I think between the editing and the writing is where his films really suffer, because he understands the genre. He knows what he wants to put in there, but he has no way to kind of like tease out details to distinguish anything. So each scene is just sort of a generic kind of sequence of people talking that lends nothing towards the larger picture of it, you know. And then he just has to slap in a voiceover going, and then I went up here to do this thing. And it's kind of like, okay, that's probably what they should have been discussing in the previous scene. Yeah. That would be traditionally how that's done. So yeah, there's this sense of domesticity and kind of like, you know, a new family forming. But yeah, no idea. Is it over a weekend? Is it, you know, have they been there for 6 months? Sid Haig's character disappears entirely. In the run-up to, there's an entirely secondary shootout that Burkett's character has with just some other guy who's supposed to be like the primary henchman of Haig's gang, who's even more anonymous than him. And that's just on some completely untouched buildings, like in a skyline in LA. Like, they just went up to a roof of a building. It looks not apocalyptic at all, and it feels like very much that feels like definitely maybe an 82 pickup sequence.
Yeah, this was the point where I was like, what in the fuck is happening here? Because I'm like, what, did Sid Haig die in this hail of incomprehensible gunfire or what? Why is he fighting this other random fellow? And I'm like, did Sid Haig just like walk off set? What the fuck's happened? Like, what is happening here? But then he returns for the last 5 minutes of the movie, and I'm like, where was Sid Haig in this entire endless fucking there's assault on the compound?
Definitely a chance Sid Haig left to make a real film, like with Jack Hill or something, like an actual film. It could have happened.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think Sid Haig has ever, stuck his nose up at a paycheck, so hey, who knows? But
well, it depends how bad the paycheck.
it is. It's so odd. Like, I don't know, to have someone with Sid Haig's level of talent and also experience doing this type of stuff, And then to, I don't know, just, it makes me wonder too. It's like, did you build, like, is the character that's in Steve Barquette's mind, is it this cerebral, kind of like calm, you know, is that the villain, you know, is this No Country for Old Men? Is that what you want from fucking Sid Haig? And what you end up doing is you're wasting this great opportunity. But you know what? I don't give a shit, because the aftermath, it may be dull and weird, but goddamn if I don't love this mustachioed dad doofus making an almost good movie. So God bless him. And then, while I will accept Steve Barquette's slander when it comes to the aftermath, I will accept none of it for Empire of the Dark, which for my money takes everything in the aftermath that I liked and just fucking turns it up to 10 with a far dumber story than you could ever conceive of. Like, the aftermath, it feels like a lower budget version of a big budget studio film, right? Whereas Empire of the Dark is just fucking beamed from space. It's you could tell that Fred Olen Ray was clapping his hands with joy when he got to produce this. It is about a guy who's a cop and he stops his Satanist cult, but whoops, even though he killed him, it turns out every 20 years they regenerate. And so they're back. And there's a baby with a mustache that looks just like him.
And it's 1990.
Jawas from Star Wars have swords and they do karate and they're actually little demons. And also Steve Barquette learns how to fight with a broadsword from a sexy lady that he wants to bang.
Because another sexy lady has reached out from beyond the grave and instructed him to learn the
process. Yeah, which is not to say he also has a sexy lady. Well, I don't know how sexy, a very square jawed woman who sleeps in his bed and she's a journalist. So basically he's got to beat the pussy off with a stick and he's never looked like he's drank more Bud Light in his life. I fucking love Steve Barquette in this.
I am willing to admit that this movie, maybe two Burkettes in a weekend is a mistake. I can kind of see the possibility of coming around in this movie. I will say I watched it, I was very bored, but I will also admit that the way, again, we're dealing with the sludge pacing, we're dealing with a film where nothing happens on repeat somehow. Like, it's somehow it's repetitive and also doesn't go forward at all. There's almost like a Fulci-esque sense of dream time to it. There's one scene early on where he's trying to find the cult sacrifice women and babies, and he has to choose between killing two dudes holding knives, one over a woman, one over a baby, and he has to decide. He's like, oh, I've only got one bullet left. If I shoot the guy who's gonna kill the woman or the baby, but the whole scene is basically starts with him running to find them, and it's just this one woman just shouting Richard over and over and over again, and it's just like, and it runs for like genuinely. I don't know how long it runs for because I don't.
It's so great because she's yelling, Richard, Richard, and then yeah, you get to the point where you're like, God, shut the fuck up, and then she finally goes, my baby, save my baby, and you're like, okay, good, she's said something different, and then she just says, my baby, like 300 more times.
Yeah,
it's so like, great.
I can understand there's something here, and this one is interesting because it does not have that production sheen or competence necessarily that the aftermath has. This looks absolutely like a Wynorski film. Mm-hmm. All the women are like of a certain kind of type. They're not quite like this, not like full of topless women. Ironically, this one I don't think has any nudity, but it does like have one scene where you have like a woman in like, you know, stock lingerie, like that every woman in a Wynorski film comes equipped with. And she happens to be a monster just for fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it doesn't have that. It doesn't have that kind of detail to it. This is definitely the one to watch. Like, if you're going to watch one of these two, I say that I think the first 10 minutes of the aftermath is by far and away the best filmmaking that Burkhead has. But Empire of the Dark is definitely more interesting from the get-go because it has that sheen of sort of like what the fuck is it? Like, this does feel like a man who shouldn't be making movies made a movie. Like,
but and, it's still pretty competent. I mean, like,
it is.
Like, beat for beat, I feel like Marquette is a more competent filmmaker than a, you know, whatever your typical Wynorski acolyte. Like, this is it's not that bad in terms of, I mean, comparatively with The Aftermath. Like, you don't get the weird like jumps and editing misses that you got in The Aftermath.
Oh, there's still plenty.
Oh, there's still plenty, which you don't get as many. Also, well, I would agree that it like production wise, there's a step down here. You still have, like, there's still some cool, like, stop motion stuff, some miniature work.
Oh yeah. No, it's very much
in, nice. They're good.
Yeah. No, it's very much in line with that, like, late 80s, early 90s, like, Wynorski kind of production element where it's cheap, but it's, you know, they have some resources. This is exactly the tier of filmmaking that Papatopoulos was lamenting was gone, effectively.
Yeah, totally.
It's right. Absolutely in that vein. And it's, you know, it works for that. It's just, it just doesn't have pacing or writing. These are the two things that are just kind of drag it down. But it's got other things. We've got Joe Pilato from Day of the Dead shows up somehow. And goddamn, a claymation version of Joe Pilato shows up at one point, which is
also
amazing.
Cool. Yeah.
So yeah, I should love this movie. And yet I was kind of by the end of being like, okay, you know, I can see some element. I would watch this again down the line. I will give this one another shot at some point, but I will say maybe sober was a mistake, if nothing else.
And there's a lot of like off-kilter performances that you can't quite put your finger on. Specifically, the woman who plays the nun is...
bizarre.
She's going for something. I don't know what it is. And then everybody else is just playing things up big. Again, The Aftermath, there's a real like subdued energy to everyone. Whereas I guess, cause they're all dying of radiation poisoning, but, with this one, everyone's at a fucking 11. Like, they have the fortune teller, what's her name, Madame Oleska or whatever.
Everyone's at 11 except for Steve and Christopher Barquette, father-son duo, who are glad, you'll be happy to know that his son returns to this film now an adult. There's many years separate the two.
Yeah.
Sporting a little mustache just like his father, and also sporting all of his father's on-screen
this
charisma.
This was such a great era for people that were like late teens, early 20s, because the difference between a 22-year-old and a 62-year-old, it was like nothing. It's just fucking inches of fucking hair off of a rat's ass, just so small. Chris Marquette, I don't know how old he was in this, but yeah, he's probably like what, like 22 or something. I don't know, he looks like he's fucking 80. It's incredible stuff.
Like, and just looks mystified throughout the whole thing. And frankly, so does Burkett to a large degree. And it's because they're just not leading men at all. You know, no. They're our heroes. And like you say, they go and they... I mean, this movie has... For reasons I don't even remember, we have a reenactment, really a restaging of the Cobra grocer shootout, Adam, in the grocer.
Yeah.
And it's terrible.
I mean, it's so broken. That's the thing about this movie to me, is that this is like maybe even more shoddy at times with some of the the spacing in this movie is just, it's fucking wild. It's wild and crazy. I don't know. It almost services this movie a little better, like to the point where it's like so broken as to be amusing. Like this grocery store shootout. My God, you tell me where anyone is at in this grocery store during this sequence and I'll fucking hand you $1,000.
I think the difference is it's very similar. Well, not technically similar because it's a little dicey, but it's like the shootout in Cobra, right? The shootout in Cobra is fantastic for a million different reasons, but it also has this great sense of space, and it gets really claustrophobic. There's that scene where like all the little soda pop cans are getting fucking blasted, and there's just like Pepsi spewing everywhere or whatever. It's fucking awesome. In this, I was just mystified because there was, when I was growing up, there was a grocery store that was probably built in like 1970 and had not been updated a single time. And it was like the only grocery store that was not owned by a corporation, a Kroger or what have you, and Albertsons, a Vons. And so it looked exactly like that, like the fucking wood paneling and everything. And I was just like enamored like up by it. And then just like seeing all the things on the shelves, I was just like, oh, like clearly Steve didn't care. He just walked into his local fucking Oklahoma grocery store, is like, hey guys, mind if we shoot a few things after hours?
There's they a said, really sure. There's a really great, like, contrasting with the Cobra thing. There's two things that kind of strike me. The first off is, which I thought was really funny, is it's your budget scope. In Cobra, the dude has like a shotgun, the guy holding up the store, and he, like, every time he shoots at someone, it's like a whole shelf explodes, like just huge, just like everything is blown to bits. In this one, there's one point where he shoots a shelf and it's like a bag of chips pops. It's like it's so much interesting more restrained.
Too, because this is another thing that kind of stuck out to me in the aftermath compared to this is in the aftermath you get kids who just get fucking like blasted with shotguns. Like a guy gets his head blown off with a shotgun pretty early on. You're like, holy shit. And they just fucking show this guy's like head like exploding. It's awesome. Whereas you get to Empire of the Dark and there's a scene where there's like two young women. I don't know if they're, again, this is the problem with the era. Are they 16 or are they 36? I don't know, but they look reasonably young. So there's these two young women and the killer, like he takes the shotgun with one hand, like an absolute fucking freak. Like he's holding like a water pistol and he blasts these two women and you think it's going to show them exploding like Steve gave us in the aftermath, but they don't show a goddamn thing. It's very sad. And I wonder why in his more action oriented, like goofball over the top film, he doesn't go for it with the gore.
Like it is strange. Some of you probably not like clarify entirely, but like the aftermath is actually like a weirdly Mondo gory film. It's almost like, you know, like a Herschel Gordon Lewis, like blood flowing kind of a film. You know, it's pretty edgy for its time, I think, even kind of, I guess. And maybe not by the early 80s when it eventually came out, but like it's a pretty grim film in that sense. This one, I feel like the missing shots of the girls is, I don't know, because probably something didn't work because either the actresses didn't want to hang around or they hooked up little squibs on them and they didn't go off right or something. And they were like, oh, fuck it. We have to open the store. But I was just going to go back because the other thing that I think is fascinating about this store, like you say, it takes place in this like kind of beautiful, kind of like completely unupdated like store, like back in the day. It just looks really retro and kind of semi rural. And it just struck me that it's kind of like, you know, Cobra is all sheen and polish. Cobra is the America of the silver screen. A complete and total fabrication. Mm-hmm. Just this shiny invention of capitalism to basically reify capitalism's own glory as this wonderful, you know, producer of interesting and intricate objects. Steve Burkett's vision of film is absolutely just like it's just a regular store, and it feels like one, and it is much more just kind of down home and ordinary, and it's kind of interesting on that level, certainly, to watch it. But like Adam says, it's also not interesting to watch it as an action sequence because it's just incomprehensible.
It's so incomprehensible that in this one instance, I feel like it almost like comes around to like the shit movie auteur thing, which this movie doesn't maintain through its runtime. Like this is the sort of movie where if I'm watching it on VHS in 1990, as is proper, you know, the only real way to watch this sort of thing, if my VCR ate the tape around the 65 minute mark, I'd be like, well, shit, what a fucking ridiculous fun movie. I gotta go seek out a copy 30 years later on eBay. But no, unfortunately, I was forced to endure the entire 93 minute runtime. And the end of this movie is you're looking for a quick goddamn nap. We'll just throw this on and your brain will just fucking shut down immediately.
Why, you don't like Jawa sword fights? And
it's just, it never ends. Dude. Like, it's impossible to pay attention to, like, beyond anything in the aftermath. Like, this finale, I was just like, it went from a movie I was really stumping for to a complete fucking dud. And you talk about, like, anytime they're in this hell space or whatever the fuck is going on, broken geography, my God, he'll be having like a close combat broadsword fight. And then it just like cuts to him like running across this rickety bridge like 17 times, and I'm like, where is he supposed to be in relation to
it's
anything?
Like an Escher painting.
It's fucking perplexing. Like, the end of this movie is, man, it is rough stuff. It is just so goddamn boring. Like, how could this big gunfight, sword fight, spectacular with a demon puppet and a bunch of crazed cultists be this boring? I don't even know how he pulls it off. It's a magic trick.
It is kind of weird because I don't know. I think it's, you would think that in a movie like this, that would be, the big engaging, like, charming moment where you just, the squibs and the violence, the action, you're like, fuck yeah. But no, it's like outside of a lingerie demon in the kitchen, it does kind of fall off after that. And it's so telling too, because I got so much more joy out of when Steve Arquette's large adult son with a mustache, he like goes into the police station early on in the movie. And it's just like this kid with a mustache awkwardly walking into what is clearly a fucking like dentist office, and the establishing shot with before he walks
police
in.
Station sign.
It's a photo of a police station that they just shot with the camera. It's fucking
what
great.
The fuck? From when? Like 1950? That ridiculous so A-frame.
But this is the thing that like it separates, because I think immediately something like Birdemic, right? One of the classic so bad it's good kind of cult hits, and Birdemic is just, it pushes that to a way I still remember, where there's a sequence where his girlfriend, who's a Victoria's Secrets model, is going to her photo shoot, and the establishing shot for the photo shoot is a one-hour photo store. because that's where photography happens for Victoria's Secrets. You're like, and it's like, I guess, getting back to like that theme, this is where Barquette kind of stumbles a little bit for me, is that it's never outrageous. It's never so outrageously incomprehensible or bad. It's just sort of middling when it falls apart. And yeah, you have that end sequence, which is, you know, I mean, it's kind of wild, but it also grates, because it's like he shows up with this huge fucking machine gun with like a drum cylinder of ammunition on it, and he just runs in there and he's just like shooting like fucking Rambo in Rambo 4 with the machine gun in the back of a truck. He's just blasting, and it's just cuts to like all these monsters being killed and falling and doing this and that, and some of them are clearly like flipped shots, you know, like they fall in lava and then the next one falls in lava, but it's the same shot but flipped, you know, and it just goes on longer than you would ever think. Like, there's so much, like the body count of this thing has to be like 100+, and 97 of them are in this sequence, and he's just blasting and blasting, and it's just constant different shots of, like, it just looks like an assemblage of shots of different special effects tests of the squibs and different parts of everyone's bodies. And then he puts the gun down and he gets a sword and he fights a little bit more with various different things, and you're kind of like, okay, this isn't great, but thank Christ we've stopped the other thing. And then he just fucking walks somewhere else and he picks up a second machine gun, and it just starts again with the blasting. It is absolutely mind-numbing.
I don't know, like, after watching these two movies, I kind of wish Barquette would have made a pure horror movie. Like, there's elements of that in The Aftermath and in Empire of the Dark, but they're mostly action drama films. I want pure horror. I actually, what he should have done is he should have remade Night of the Demon, the old black and white one, old black and white one. Is it Jacques Tournier? Is that who did Night of the Demon?
Jacques Tournier. Yeah.
I want that, but Steve Barquette, because Like the demon shit in this is awesome. You know, there's like before we get to the big action finale, there's like two kids make it out in a fucking Chevy, and then the giant demon puppet comes and stomps on them and it rocks. And I want more of that. But unfortunately, Steve Marquette, he never was able to raise funds and make another film again. And I wonder, you know, did he fall out of love with directing, or was he just kind of disenchanted by the whole process? Clearly, he stuck around because, yeah, he did acting roles for Fred Olen Ray and Wynorski and those guys like through the 90s, all the way through the 90s. And it's just so odd to me that he never took another swing. So weird.
There's still time, maybe. I don't know.
He died.
No, he's died.
Oh, he died? Oh, no.
He died like 2 years ago, yeah.
Oh, man. No, maybe there's something in his garage.
2023? Oh, God, he only died a year ago. That's so sad.
Holy shit, he made it through COVID. What the fuck? Come on,
yeah.
Steve.
But he died of pneumonia, strangely enough, yeah. And it was weird because there was no, like, announcement or anything about, like, no, not that he's the biggest filmmaker, but, like, Jim Wynorski was the person who told everyone, like him and Fred Olen Ray, just like went on the internet. And they're like, "Hey, this guy died. That sucks."
We should make mention that his like sidekick in this film is Richard Harrison, who's probably, it feels like, maybe the only actor who fully gets what he's doing.
Yeah,
he feels right, and I mean, you'll recognize him from if you've slipped into the Godfrey Ho hell spiral, because he must have filmed like an hour's worth of footage that Godfrey Ho repurposed for 75 movies.
Yeah. No, he's been in a lot of stuff. Yeah. If you've seen a trashy movie on Tubi from the 80s or the 90s, particularly Godfrey Ho, but even beyond that, there's a chance you've seen him before. So he totally gets it.
Oh, you've seen him. You've seen him. And he's fun in this. Like he's actually pitched correctly, which,
yeah,
is rare in these.
Also, I should have done a Richard Harrison episode for Hunk Month, because if you go on his IMDb profile, the little biography says the mighty muscle bound actor Richard Harrison was one of a slew of handsome American pectoral hunks. That's the first part of it.
Yeah, apparently he got to start doing like beach films.
Yeah, a beach baby. I love it.
I always appreciate an IMDb profile that sounds very much like it was written by the actor themselves or a relative of the actor, but that's its own beautiful thing. Yeah, this movie also, I mean, again, Joe Pilato is in there, and I think he's kind of having fun, but he's not in there long, so
right.
If you're a real Pilato head, you know, just set your expectations appropriately.
Yeah, well, we should probably wrap things up, but I just want to say, despite the disparaging remarks from Adam Myros and slightly less disparaging, but disparaging nonetheless, remarks from Jack Eason, Steve Marquette is a golden god. And you know what? There's some interesting shit in here. Maybe have a couple beers.
I don't know.
Maybe when has Adam Myros ever been right in his entire life?
I think he's more interesting to discuss than it's his actual films. Like his films are fucking boring.
I think, you know, just absolutely
straight up boring.
That's it. No, you, like, it's interesting to think about why his movies aren't more fun to watch than they are. That's basically the Marquette promise.
I don't know. Next time you're up here, Jack, I'm gonna make you butt chug a full bottle of whiskey, and then we're gonna watch Empire of the Dark, and maybe you're gonna change your mind.
I mean, sure, yeah. If you just alter space and time, that's who knows? Sky's the limit. Yeah.
It might start to make sense.
All right, Myros, what are you putting over this week?
Well, as per always, I haven't watched jack shit.
Typical.
But, you know, I'm going to put over something that I feel like Steve Marquette must have been watching on a loop before he made his films, which is The Omega Man. Just watch that if you want to get this experience, except, you know, fun to watch and paced with some level of professional acumen. Because, again, I feel like Steve Marquette was just delusional enough to think he was Charlton Heston. And these, especially Aftermath, is like laced with these like 60s and 70s Heston sci-fi films. And yeah, I Omega Man is what came to mind for me watching these. And that's an actual goofy, fun movie. So watch that. It's good.
Jack, what are you putting over this week?
So, I mean, we talk about, we have various examples of vanity projects for middle-aged men deciding that they're just going to go and make a movie. But what about vanity projects from slightly younger women? There's not so many of those, sadly. But there is one that's starting to percolate around the country after Warner Brothers tried to bury it on a cease and desist letter. And that is The People's Joker by Vera Drew, which I happened to catch last Friday at a sold out screening. And it was a lot of fun. It's a very insane film. For anyone who doesn't know anything about it, basically it's Vera Drew describes it as like a fair use autobiographical story. It is very heavily leaning on the fair use concept to allow them to use the characters of DC's Batman to basically tell a story of trans upbringing and identity and struggles. But it is also very, very funny. Vera Drew worked with Absolutely Productions with Tim and Eric for several years, did a bunch of Adult Swim stuff. She's got lots of credentials. You'll find this throughout the movie. She called in, I guess, every favor she could. So, I mean, for example, this is a movie that stars a really shoddily CG Lorne Michaels voiced by Maria Bamford. This is just something that occurs in the film. This is a film that has a cameo footage of Robert Vool in it, just because why not? And she says that she reached out to him when she put it in to offer him more money because she felt bad, and they came to an arrangement. It's an insane movie. It's all over the place. It's chaotic, but it's very, very funny. Does everything in it work? Hard to even say, because it's just such an absolutely singularly strange construction of a film. So yeah, People's Joker. It's Altered Innocence have picked it up. People might know as one of the partner labels for Vinegar Syndrome right now, who specialize in queer cinema. So it's percolating around the country now. They settled their legal issues with Warner Brothers, maybe with a couple of edits, I think, and an extra disclaimer among, you know, this is not associated with us and so on. So keep an eye out. It's definitely going to go to VOD eventually. It's going to get a Blu-ray release, which is going to feature a lot of supplements, including, Vera Drew assured us, extra footage of a show called Suicide Cop that she made with some friends. Years, they made a full 30-minute pilot, and sadly she says they're probably not going to visit the full 30-minute pilot on us. But it's based on about a cop who is compelled to commit suicide and hates it and is agonized throughout the whole process but keeps committing suicide, and they use footage of that throughout the movie. Insane film, but I definitely recommend it. Watch it with some friends, sit down, have fun. It's something, that's for damn sure.
I'm gonna catch it next week. It's playing at the Cactus Club here, which is weird because the Cactus Club is like a, I don't know, like a 100 person capacity standing room only music venue. But sure, I'll go see a fucking movie there. Why not?
I'd say that will be a great venue. I think you'll have a good damn time.
All right. Cheap drinks too. Shout out Cactus Club. All right. Well, I'm gonna put over a movie that I revisited for the first time in a long time. And you know, we're talking about Steve Barquette as this kind of like, you know, ego-driven vanity project filmmaker. And the problem that you run into with that is, you know, especially when you don't have any formal training or, you know, you're not some super talent, you try to insert yourself in certain things and you're not good at everything. I know I'm not, you know, if I were to buy the Detroit Pistons tomorrow and put myself in the starting lineup, I'd be better than 2/3 of the Pistons bench, but I still wouldn't be that good. So, you know, there's things you can't do.
It's because
do.
Of the degradation of competence,
yeah,
Steve.
You know?
Ask your grandpa. He probably could have played for the Pistons in 1930 and maybe averaged like 3 points.
He probably would have been okay. Honestly. Yeah. I mean, I don't come from a long line of athletes. It's pretty clear when you see me in person, but I did. My great grandpa. Yeah. I guess it'd be my great grandpa. He was the punter for the Green Bay Packers. So there you go. I don't think he could do that today. Probably not. Huh? But anyways, the point is, on the opposite end of the spectrum, I think there's people that you can just slot into things, and through just pure charisma and talent and force of will, they can take something that is utterly mediocre and just drag it kicking and screaming into something special. And I realized when I was watching Beverly Hills Cop, that is exactly what Eddie Murphy does. Beverly Hills Cop, you want to talk about a movie that's kind of like formless and doesn't have a great script or really anything remotely original going on outside of like someone in the span of 12 hours sat down and wrote a police movie. Eddie Murphy just riffing and just being Eddie Murphy is fucking hilarious. It is amazing the way that he elevates the material. And his work in Beverly Hills Cop, it might only be topped by his work in Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I don't think is as good, but it is literally an exact clone of the first movie. And Eddie Murphy makes it good, which is crazy to me. So, yeah, go watch some Beverly Hills Cop. Go watch some Beverly Hills Cop 2. Fuck it.
Yeah, it's been rough that I think the entire mode has of Hollywood comedy has moved over to the Eddie Murphy model, but without Eddie Murphy or anyone as talented and charismatic as Eddie Murphy at that point in time. But it's like, yeah, just get these people to riff. It'll be hilarious. And that's why Hollywood has not produced a decent studio comedy in about 15 years.
No, it's fucking embarrassing. This is why we have, you know, you people are enablers. You fucking elevate your Taika Waititi's, and then what do? They look what that did. That's your fault. Think about that. But yeah, it is fucked up that they really prioritize personality over writing, but they don't have the fucking personalities. There's one Eddie Murphy, and it's Eddie Murphy, and he can do this, and you can't. So remember that always. And with that, if you enjoyed the show today, do us a big favor. Click the link in the description and that'll take you to our Patreon. And when you get to our Patreon, you can give us money. And why would you give us money? What a wonderful question. Well, it helps us keep this podcast alive. Podcasts cost money. Microphones cost money. Me figuring out how to record Steve Coleman when he's sitting 5 feet across from me and not fuck it up. That took a lot of cords that I would, you know, you have to pay money to buy cords. It's important. And you know what the thing is, though? If you give us money, it's not like we're not giving you anything in return. We're not complete assholes. Far from it. You're going to get access to the exclusive Optimism Vaccine Patreon feed. And we've got a brand new episode of Costed Content that is recorded. Producer Colin is editing it as we speak, I think, I don't know. Or maybe he forgot about it. Who's to say?
Yeah.
But well, it's out there. It'll be up soon. It's done.
Maybe even before this.
Yeah. It's in the can, baby. So it'll be on there soon. We got tons and tons of patron exclusive content. There's written stuff. There's old podcasts. There's everything. Everything you'd ever need. It's all there, baby. And it's for you. And on top of that, you're a new patron. You live in the continental United States. I will send you a movie from my personal collection. And it probably won't suck because I am a man of refined taste. No one has taste like me. People are saying this. They're saying it more and more. I have the best taste. It's incredible taste. And so you will get that in the mail. So at the very least, you donate like $3 and you get a free fucking movie. Like, that's probably worth it, you know? So think about that, maybe. On top of that, if you want to donate at a higher tier, $5, we'll let you vote in patron polls. We got another one of those coming up soon. And you get your name read out on the air. Myros, who are five and above patrons right now?
Well, let me add real quick that if you're interested in this sort of discussion, and interested in what might now exist on these streaming services with these self-styled auteurs in the digital age, you're going to be interested in what we're doing with Caustic Content.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to see just how far it has slipped now that you don't even have to bother paying for film stock or stuff like that. So, yeah, plenty of these discussions continuing. For our patrons, yeah.
We found out you don't even have to make the movie anymore. You just AI it. Yeah. It's fucking crazy.
It's fascinating. We did have a movie that seems to be at least significantly made by a machine learning.
Christ, so that, yeah, that's, no, I think AI probably is going to kill the concept because there's no bottom anymore.
Yeah, there's really not.
All right. Well,
there's just your self-respect. That's the only limitation left.
Oh, there is no such thing among these folks, Jack. Not these folks, though. These folks, fine folks, respectable folks.
They don't like
respect
AI.
For others.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it has its place, but first we have to work on the living wage. Yeah, we have David, Evan, Ryan, Dustin, and Paula. Thank you for your support this month.
God bless every single one of them. Yeah. And then, of course, if you want to donate either as a reoccurring or just as a one-time, one-month thing, $25 or more. And for $25, you can pick an entire episode. Maybe you're saying, man, I would really love to hear what Steve and Myros and Jack, or maybe Jake, or maybe Sean Glynnis, or maybe whoever the fuck else we run around with, has to say about the Beverly Hills Cop series. And I'm only using that as an example because I would love to just watch part three because I've watched one and two recently. But yeah.
Be careful what you wish for. Nobody likes that.
I don't know. It can't be that bad. How bad could it be? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
It could be bad.
Yeah, but anyways, whatever you want, whether it's Beverly Hills Cop, or maybe you're like, man, it would be great if they watch 48 Hours and another 48 Hours. Sure, we'll do that. We'll do anything. Doesn't fucking matter. All the Lethal Weapons, all of them, all the diehards, including the two that I always confuse, the ones from the
2000s. How many? I don't even know how many of them there are now.
Die Hard, there's Die Harder, there's Die Hard with a Vengeance.
There's three of them for sure, and then yeah. After that, I don't know.
And then
know.
There's A Good Day to Die Hard and Live Free or Die Hard, but I always forget which one comes before the
you've
other.
You've got those inverted.
Oh, okay.
Live Free is 4, and A Good Day is the one that killed it well and truly dead.
Well, they both stink. Anyways.
Yeah.
Whatever. 2's good though. People sleep on 2. What, you don't like fucking Die Hard with airplanes? I'm sorry. Sounds like your fucking problem. You just like
the Michigan representation.
I think Michigan representation. Always. But yeah, give us $25. I'll watch the Live Free or Die Hard. Watch me. I'll do it. And yeah, if you have any questions, comments, death threats, or marriage proposals, optimismvaccine@gmail.com. We love to get emails. We love suggestions for episodes. We love anything. Anything that you have to say. Myros is, he's hitting refresh on the inbox. And finally, if you want to hit us up on social, Optimism Vaccine, find us. We're there. We're around. You'll find us. We'll be back next week.